alternative meetings that took place between our Senate closure for the day and starting of this committee meeting. Let's take up, we'll do some order here. We'll start with Senate Bill 926 because Catherine Weber is in charge of that one. And then we'll move to Senate Bill 123, 129, and, excuse me, I mean 924. Isn't that right?
924 is the first one.
Yes, 924 is the first item on the agenda today. And then we'll move into 926 as well. And then we'll take up the sentencing guidelines bill and begin with 1073 on that arena when we get down to that. Hardy is here, so. Let's call up the witnesses on Senate Bill 924. The City of Portland has requested this bill. Catherine, you might want to.
Yeah, this bill changes the State Tort Claim Act to allow local entities, as the state now can, to pay costs of defense and indemnity for employees who are being sued when it's subsequently found that they acted outside the scope of their duty or with malfeasance or acted with willful and wanton neglect. It's Senate Bill 924.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Harry Auerbach, Deputy City Attorney, appearing in favor of Senate Bill 924. I want to thank the committee for considering this bill, which it has introduced at the request of the City of Portland. The purpose of our requesting the bill was to put us on the same foot that the state was put on by a legislative change in 1985. At that time, the indemnification section of the Tort Claims Act was changed so that the Attorney General could make the determination as to coverage at the beginning, at the outset of the claim, and then stick by it, regardless of the result that ultimately obtained. The way that the Tort Claims Act is written, there are the public bodies are required to defend and indemnify their employees for claims arising out of the performance of their duties with certain exceptions. And the exceptions are if it's not in the scope of employment or duties, or if it is an act or omission that amounts to willful or wanton neglect of duty or malfeasance in office. The statute requires that all public bodies, when requested to defend an employee under this act, make a determination as to whether the claim is covered by the act, and that if the public body determines that the claim is outside the scope of coverage, either because it's not in the doesn't arise out of the performance of duty, or because it amounts to willful or wanton neglect of duty or malfeasance in office, then the public body is required to reject defense of the claim. This much is true even now as to both the state and public bodies, local public bodies. In 1985, the state changed got a change for the last part of their statute, which still exists for local governments, which is that regardless of the decision that the public body makes as to coverage, if the judgment ultimately rendered discloses that the claim is outside the scope of coverage, then the public body can't pay and the employee is required to reimburse the public body for the cost of defense. Now, I've worked for the City of Portland for almost 7 years, and in that time I think we have rejected defense of three or four claims. This is something that does not happen with a great deal of frequency. It's a fairly rare occurrence that something happens that's outside the scope of coverage. There has never, to my knowledge, been a judgment ultimately rendered on a claim in which we have originally accepted defense that has disclosed that the claim is outside the scope of coverage. That is, no judgment that we've ultimately received has told us that we made the wrong coverage decision. What has happened is that because at the outset we are required to advise individuals whom we represent as to the limited nature of the defense and indemnification that we can give them under the statute, there arises a sort of residual mistrust between the employee and the attorneys defending him, which makes the employee perceive that there may be a hidden risk out there of personal liability, which in fact does not really exist. We would like to remove that so that we can more effectively and efficiently defend the claims that we have determined we are obliged to defend. And that's why we've made this request.
Are there any questions? Senator Springer.
Let me think of a couple circumstances here and tell me how the city would respond. Say you've got a water bureau employee performing his or her duties out there, and they're out meeting with one of the citizens, and they get into a little fracas, which turns physical, and your employee is accused of assault and battery. What's the city's position on that in terms of its duty to defend?
Well,
I know it turns on the facts.
Yes. If a claim is made, as I presume under these facts one would be made, it would be investigated by the Bureau of Risk Management. The Bureau of Risk Management would probably, I think, Senator, the best way to answer it is if the altercation was related to the work-related purpose for which the Water Bureau employee was at the scene, we would probably accept defense of the claim. A tort claim is based on, at least those that are rightly brought, are based on some sort of wrongful conduct. So clearly the statute contemplates that not all wrongful conduct by public employees is outside the scope of their performance or duties or outside or willful or wanton neglect of duty or malfeasance in office. The statute obviously contemplates some wrongful conduct as being a necessary exposure of doing business as a public body. So if it's related to the purpose for which the public employee was there, we would probably accept defense of the claim.
Let's change facts slightly. Let's say the person had a long lunch hour and popped a few pills and was operating a vehicle and wiped out a couple folks. Operating one of your vehicles.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, there is case law in this state, and I haven't read it this morning, so I can't remember which way the pendulum ultimately swung in the case. But there is some case law in this state that indicates that the voluntary consumption of drugs, if done because of work pressures, can be related to work. So we would have to take a look at the facts of the case and make a determination as to whether it's covered under the scope of our obligation to defend. I do want to point out, though, that the fact that we have to defend a civil action doesn't mean that we condone the conduct, and that any time that there is wrongful conduct by a public employee, there are disciplinary processes available that we can utilize and do utilize to try to correct bad behavior by public employees.
Last question, if I may, Madam Chair. Do you ever find yourself in a conflict situation with your own employee, depending on the way the case is pled? And what do you do if that's the case?
There is, from time to time, either a potential conflict of interest or an actual conflict of interest among some or all of the people who are sued in an action who are employed by the same government body. When that happens, if the conflict is actual, we are still within the scope of coverage of the act, we employ outside counsel at a significant expense to the public body. If it's a potential conflict, then we deal with it according to the disciplinary rules. If we can defend people, we will. If we can't, we won't. If there is a conflict of interest, outside counsel will be employed.
Real last question. Would this have any impact on all the litigation that's taken place between Commissioner Koch and the city?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I doubt it.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thanks very much. Paul Snyder. Paul Snyder without his briefcase this time. We can't provide that.
I haven't met it, Chair, but it's in the back of the room. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. In a communication I just received this morning, I have been advised of some opposition to this bill by at least one county. And I'm not entirely clear on the reasons for that, Madam Chair, and I'd like to discuss it with representatives of the City of Portland. But if I understand correctly the concern, it has to do with the notion that under some circumstances, even in the case where the county defends, if it turns out later that employees working outside the course and scope of employment, it may not be appropriate to indemnify. But I'll discuss it further with the city, Madam Chair, and
okay, see so if you we'll look forward to either your further communication with staff, please, to find out what the opposition is and if there's any way to remedy it within the bill, like exempting out the counties. And that's
yes, I will.
Further comments, further questions for Paul?
Not for Paul, Madam Chair. Maybe sure. For our own council. What is the state of the law with regard to the state?
We just passed it.
Yeah, the state had a change two sessions ago which said that they could pay even if the judgment determined that the employee was acting outside the scope.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, then unless there's someone else to testify on Senate Bill 924, we'll close the public hearing on that bill. And we'll have a change of counsel. And move to Senate Bill, let's see,
'm sure there's some disagreement whether that has very good support. I asked through my assistant if we could put it off for a little while until I gained, and my judge was only able to tell him Friday, and he couldn't come over.
Okay, well, let's wait then until we hear from you and your office, and we'll postpone temporarily until we're further posted. 926. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a Brenneman bill, and we'll wait till either you all work on amendments or get ready to go ahead and decide what you want to do about that then.
Thank you,
John. Okay, then let's move to Senate Bill 123 relating to parole. And we have signed up. Vern Fotz is here for the parole board. This is at the request of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and the State Board of Parole. So we'll hear what you have to say about Senate Bill 123. Jack, do you want to make any comments before we get on?
No, it's a relatively straightforward bill, and Mr. Fotz will do a better job of explaining it.
Pick 129 first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vern Fotz. I'm chairman of the Board of Parole. And with me is Mrs. Cindy Burgess, who is both staff to the Board of Parole and staff the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards. And we'll be talking later about the about Senate Bill 123 that the Advisory Commission is
primarily concerned. You're going to start with 129?
I'd rather start with 129.
Fine.
If you can. That's a fairly straightforward housekeeping measure. And I think Mr. Morris has already indicated that to you. We're trying here to correct an ambiguity in Chapter 144 of those statutes pertaining to sanctions for parole violators. And here we have 144.343 and 144.390, both of which say that the board may revoke parole and require that the violator serve the remaining balance of the sentence as provided by law. And then 144.395, which indicates that the board shall adopt rules consistent with the criteria in 144.780 relating to the re-release of persons whose parole has been revoked. Now, obviously, we have statutes in conflict here, and we feel that the board has authority to re-release parole violators pursuant to rule. We have adopted those rules. And they provide for parole violation sanctions of 6 and 12 months with variations for aggravation or mitigation on reincarceration. We also have the option of denying re-release on parole if the criminal behavior is such as to warrant that. And we think, therefore, that the rules are consistent with statutory intent, but will be clearer if Senate Bill 129 is passed and these other two statutes are deleted. And then Section 2 of Senate Bill 129 deletes a reference to probation. The board does not have any authority regarding probation violations.
Other questions? Cindy, would you like to comment on this bill at all? Okay. Anyone have any questions of Vern on the matter of Senate Bill 129? Then let's close the hearing on Senate Bill 129 and move to Senate Bill 123.
I might mention, Madam Chair, on Senate Bill 123, there is some written testimony from Mr. Foss. There's also a fiscal impact statement that no fiscal impact is anticipated.
Now, I'm here on Senate Bill 123 as chairman of the advisory or chairperson of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards. And Senate Bill 123 is a little more complicated than Senate Bill 129, and it relates to the method of establishing parole release dates for persons sentenced to consecutive terms of imprisonment. And you may want to refer to the matrix here as we go through this. And I'm going to be referring to the terms principal range and base range. The principal range is the matrix range that considers a prison's criminal history risk score. And the score could be poor, fair, good, or excellent, as you see across the top of the chart. And the base range does not consider the prisoner's criminal history. It is always the excellent column. It's always the 0, 9 to 11 column marked excellent on the matrix. And for any particular crime, a person whose range is computed under the excellent column is treated as if he has an excellent or no criminal history at all. Now, in response to the increased use of consecutive sentences by judges and the emerging problem of prison crowding as early as 1981, the board adopted rules that allowed it to use the principal crime, and we're talking now about consecutive sentences. The principal range for the crime with the longest sentence, and then add the base ranges to that for a unified matrix range when an inmate was committed with consecutive sentences. Now, I'll try to give you an example, and you can look at the matrix and see how this works. We have a history risk score of 5, a crime category of 6. The range in that case is 40 to 52 months. That's the fair column, 03 to 05. The base range, if you were not considering the criminal history, would be 16 to 24 months. Just for your clarification. Now, in February of 1987, the board was advised by the Attorney General that we didn't have the authority to adopt that rule. And we came to the Legislative Assembly and worked out House Bill 3384, which was a compromise bill that gave us the authority to sum the matrix ranges as we had been doing, with the exception of certain relatively more serious crimes. And if the prisoner had been convicted of one of those crimes, then the matrix ranges for all of his crimes in a consecutive sentencing structure had to be figured on the principal range. And those more serious crimes were murder, kidnapping, assault 1, rape 1, sodomy 1, sexual penetration with a foreign object, arson 1, and treason. Now, House Bill 3384 contained a sunset provision with a date of July 1, 1989, and it also required that the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards make recommendations to this Legislative Assembly regarding the appropriate method of establishing release dates for persons sentenced to consecutive terms of imprisonment. And Senate Bill 123 is the recommendation developed by the Advisory Commission in consultation with the Criminal Justice Council and the Governor's Legal Counsel. Subsection 2 of Section 1 of Senate Bill 123 adds to those serious crimes that I identified for you previously. adds attempted murder, manslaughter 1, and robbery 1 to that list of crimes. And this was done because assault 1 was already on the list. Attempted murder, manslaughter, and robbery 1 are seen to be equally as serious as assault 1. Now, Senate Bill 123 will provide that if a crime is on the list, the board must use the prisoner's principal range in the computation of consecutive sentences. If the crime is not on the list, the principal range will be used for the crime with the longest sentence and the base range then for additional crimes. And this change is seen as a way to simplify the statute to prevent further crowding of the prisons if, to prevent further crowding of the prisons. If Senate Bill 123 is not passed, this law sunsets, all prison terms will then be set using principal ranges, and that will have a very dramatic impact on prison crowding. I think these amendments are straightforward, relatively simple. With them, we can set prison terms that provide maximum sanctions for people who have the most serious and dangerous offenses, while still recognizing and providing for consecutive sentences for the relatively less serious offenders. Any questions?
Do you have a sense of what you say it has a dramatic effect on prison crowding? Do we have a sense of what the numbers that are coming through your the board that have these kind of sentences attached that you deal with on an ongoing basis?
Madam Chair, I don't have those figures with me, and I'm sorry I failed to bring them along. But we are seeing, and we have over the last number of years, seen increasing numbers of consecutive sentences, and this is the judge's attempt to get what he or she feels is an appropriate length of time in the penitentiary for the person who's committing the crimes.
I guess I'd ask that you forward them on. We'll pass them out to committee members to see.
All right, we'll do
it's
that.
Helpful to us to understand what, when you say, we'll also ask the counsel or whomever might have some information to find out what the consequences.
I may be able to give you some very
specific. And the split
specific.
Between the ones that are on the list and those that are not on the list that are getting consecutives now. I mean, I don't know if you have that information, that are coming in with judges from consecutives of the ratio of the ones that are on the list and off the list.
I think we can work with the Department of Corrections to try to pull that information together for you.
Other questions? Yeah, it would be a real interest to me to find out how many of those that are not on the list are you actually getting referred with consecutives on them from and further. It would be nice to have that by county if you can get it.
I don't think we can pull that out by county.
Okay, anyone else have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we need to import some House Judiciary Committee members to give us some spice to our committee here. Let's call up then, we're left with the Criminal Justice Council, call up Hardy, Myers. We've had communication from Kathleen that you want to start with 1073, Hardy. Is that it? Whatever your pleasure is.
If that would be agreeable to the chair, yes.
Okay. Why don't you begin?
Madam Chair, members.
You look for 1073.
Public Committee. I'm Hardy Myers, Chair of the Criminal Justice Council, and with me is Bob Durston, Council Staff and Manager of the Guidelines Project. Mm-hmm. The 87 guidelines legislation directed the council to submit to the legislature all recommended legislative changes that the council believed were necessary to implement the guidelines. And Senate Bill 1073 is the bill that really collects almost, or I guess I could say, all of those into a single vehicle. They, as you will see, combine provisions that are intended to cleanly separate the old indeterminate sentencing structure from the new one. There are various provisions that are intended to clearly buttress provisions in the rules and make clear there was authority to include them. And then there are certain absolutely indispensable provisions like the new appellate review section, which are critical to the onset of a new system that's controlled a great deal more by law. With those preliminaries, then, Madam Chair, members, I'd like to have Bob begin walking the committee through the bill, if that would be the agreeable approach to you, Madam Chair.
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's Senate Bill 1073. The first provisions, sections 1 and 2, add a new provision to the section of the Penal Code related to plea discussions and agreements. The section 2 is the substantive section. It lays out the rules on plea negotiations as they will be exercised under the guideline systems. As you will recall, during our presentation of the sentencing guidelines rules, the rules themselves include very specific provisions on how plea negotiations will take place. Those same rules have been here drafted in statutory form, so there's no confusion as to how they will be implemented during the process. Subsection 1 of Section 2 indicates that criminal history records will always be accurately reflected and demonstrated to the sentencing judge. Subsection 2 indicates that an offender's classification on the guidelines grid can be a topic of a plea negotiations, so that the parties can both agree that the offender should be placed in a specific grid block on the guidelines grid. This is with the proviso that in reaching that agreement, the criminal history would not be misrepresented. So in all cases, the offender will be properly classified on the criminal history scale of the grid. Subsection 3 indicates that once a grid block has been identified and the offender has been classified for sentencing purposes, the judge is still free to depart from the sentence, but if he or she does so, it could result in the withdrawal of the plea, and if it does not, the judge would still be required to identify those substantial reasons for the departure sentence. Subsection 4 indicates that when an agreement takes place, the parties may stipulate to a specific sentence within the sentence range. As you'll remember, the grid blocks indicate for prison, for example, a range that could involve a number of months. The sentencing judge is free when accepting one of those stipulated sentences to sentence anywhere in that range, and that could be part of the plea agreement. Finally, the parties may stipulate to a sentence outside the presumptive sentence if the parties come into the sentencing judge and say, for these reasons, judge, we feel that a departure sentence is appropriate. This is where we agree that the offender should be classified, but for these reasons, a departure sentence is appropriate. The judge may accept that plea, but in doing so, we'll have to indicate on the record the reasons for accepting the plea and the reasons for accepting the departure sentence or imposing departure sentence.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Senator Hill. You can depart up or down, is that right?
Senator Hill, that is correct.
You have reasons for each way.
Moving to sections 3, 4, and 5, these have to do with the accusatory instrument. Section 3 is merely a codification instruction. Section 4 indicates that in filing the accusatory instruments, the district attorney shall allege those facts sufficient to classify the offense on the crime seriousness scale. In most cases, this will not involve any new information. The district attorney will allege those facts for which there is an offense violation alleged. In the case where there is a subcategory offense, say, for example, burglary, which has three subcategories, the district attorney under this provision would be required to indicate what subcategory and what factor would place that offender in the appropriate subcategory. In Section 5, this amends a current statutory provision, ORS 135.815. This requires that that a summary of the defendant's criminal record would be part of the information that the state is required to provide to the defendant. Because criminal history will now play a more important role in the sentencing decision, it was determined that this information should be provided to the defendant to allow him or her to make that part of his case when the sentencing comes, if it comes to that. Section 6, we now enter into the provision.
Excuse me, can I stop you, Bob? Is there a time frame on that? We had some debate about when. Is that going to be in another part, or we decided not to deal with that? Like when that criminal history comes to the defendant's?
Madam Chair, that will come in another part. A proper issue for appellate review, but when those issues, when that issue is raised, the appellate court's scope of review will be limited to determining whether the facts that were given for the departure, one, are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and two, whether those reasons constitute a substantial reason for departure. It's important here to note that under the current rules, the standard for departures is a substantial and compelling reasons. We received testimony from Judge Joseph that many of his colleagues felt the two words and compelling were somewhat redundant and did not add substantially to the term substantial. And for that reason, they requested us to delete the two words. For the purposes of this statute, they have been deleted. They remain in the guidelines rules, but those rules will be considered when and if the Sentencing Guidelines Board has that extended authority to make those revisions.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you mention that a sentence that was reached as a result of plea bargaining would not be appealable, the length of sentence?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that's correct. That's in the situation as we were outlining that first, in the first section of the bill. Section 2 of the bill indicates that there is a process, and all the parties are well informed of the consequences. So if an offender agrees, it was determined that should not be subject later to appeal, just the sentencing issue.
You mean just the length of the sentence?
That's correct.
Just one second. And now I'm sorry. Going back to there's a process that ensures that should not be a problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, because of the guidelines add so much structure to the sentencing process, an offender will be able through counsel to know exactly what the sentence will be if they agree to the plea negotiation.
And so this assumes that everything is in order in terms of representations of, I guess it's troubling that under no circumstances would that be appealable. What about where there's some kind of fraud or misinformation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I believe, and I could be corrected by other representatives from the council, that in those cases where the defendant indicates that he had bad advice of counsel or there was some kind of deliberate misinformation, I believe that could be raised. But that would not be an issue of sentencing. I think that would be an issue of adequate representation.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Springer.
Maybe kind of following up on that inquiry, and I hope I didn't miss this in your presentation or discussion of Section 20, but reading that with these new amendments, how would the court or either the trial court, sentencing court, or the appellate court handle a situation which, say, 40 days after the sentence or judgment had been entered, finds out that there's material fact that was just in error and the parties acted innocently upon that error? As I read these amendments, I mean, that would be, everyone agrees there's an error, but the court's lost jurisdiction, Court of Appeals presumably can act upon that, but as I read the language here in the amendments, you talk about no substantial question of law. We're talking about a fact question. What happens in that situation? Or would that, quote, be a question of law?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I believe
I can understand the need for a summary disposition. You know, presumably everybody says, hey, we made a mistake, get it back to us for resentencing. Without having to go through some...
It's an issue that was raised on the appeal. Senator Springer, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No,
Senator
go ahead.
Springer, are you saying it was raised as an issue on appeal?
Well, it...
I think he's asking, what are you going to...
May or may not.
Can you appeal it? How would you go about...
May or may not be an issue on appeal. I mean, the person may have not requested an appeal otherwise, although that would maybe be the unusual circumstance. But if it is raised on appeal, how would the court handle that? Could they proceed in a summary fashion to handle that question?
You want to get back to us on that question?
That's fine if you want to confer about it a little bit. Granted, this is not the kind of thing that would necessarily happen, hopefully, after a while, but...
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, in Minnesota, they have a provision that allows the sentencing court to retain jurisdiction throughout the offender's sentenced period to conform the sentence to comply with the requirements of law. As Kay Knapp, who's the former director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, indicates that broad language allowed the sentencing court to address specific errors, as you suggest. The reason I believe that a 30-day limit was in place was we felt that if that kind of a fact situation doesn't come up in 30 days, it's not likely to arise. But there's an alternative to broaden that scope.
So the alternative would be to look at something like the Minnesota language and check it out with other people if you wanted, if it turned out to be a concern.
Madam Chair, that's certainly an option.
I think too, Madam Chair, unless I'm mistaken, that in the Minnesota procedure, the Minnesota Guidelines Commission has made it a practice in receiving these sentencing reports to examine them from the standpoint of correctness in terms of clerical calculations. And does it have a formal process for notifying the court and parties when it believes an error has occurred? So this provision was also, I think, viewed as kind of meshing with that expected process under our own procedure, that when the Oregon Council, at least staff, have reviewed sentencing reports and believe an error has occurred, we would expect there would arise a process of communicating that to the court and parties, and that this provision would would increase the possibility for the authority for the court to act on that kind of situation.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll flag it, Senator Springer, and we'll get some information and discuss it a little more. Anything else before we move on?
Madam Chair, continuing, just to reemphasize as far as the court's role in reviewing sentences which are departures, the terminology, substantial reasons, it should be understood this is more than just a mere substantial evidence test. This is that the court will look at the sentence imposed, look at the principles that are captured in the guidelines rules in the first few rules of the guidelines, outline the principles of sentencing. The court will need to review those rules and determine whether in the case before it, the circumstances, the factual evidence that was presented, all led the judge to the conclusion that for this offender is unique for sentencing purposes based on the just deserts and the public safety features of these guidelines.
Again, quickly to add, Madam Chair, as I think we made clear during the testimony on the rules, it was the board's, council and board's view, and I don't think this is at variance with that, that what the legislature meant by substantial and compelling was essentially what we understand now to be aggravating or mitigating facts. And as you will recall, the rules try to set forth a starting set of examples for the guidance of trial judges in assessing whether a particular fact is a basis for a departure.
Moving on to subsection 3, this also provides what other types of sentences may be raised on appeal. The first section, or first paragraph, outlines when the court, a sentence may be appealed on the grounds that the sentencing court failed to comply with the requirements of law in imposing or failing to impose a sentence. For example, perhaps the optional probation sentences. In the guidelines rules, it's provided that an optional probationary sentence may be provided for offenders in those three grid blocks, but the judge has to make three findings in order to impose it. One is that there was no gun or weapon involved in the commission of the crime. The offender was not on a custody status for a prior conviction. And three, that the probation programs were better suited to the public safety concerns in preventing future criminal conduct than would be a term of imprisonment. If in the case that the offender did, in fact, was armed, and it was proven at trial that the offender was armed, but the judge nonetheless imposed a probationary sentence and imposed it as an optional probation or a probation option, the state could appeal in that case, claiming that the sentencing court failed to comply with the rules on that option. The other type of sentence under subsection 3 that will be available for appellate review is that the sentencing court erred in making the proper crime seriousness or a criminal history classification for the offender. Both of these aspects of the guidelines are critical to the sentence actually imposed. Either the crime of conviction was misclassified, especially when we're talking about, well, in this case it would be the subcategorization of an offense, or in determining what does in fact constitute that individual offender's criminal history record. If an error related to either of those two aspects of sentencing is claimed, that may be raised as a grounds for sentencing or appealing the sentence. Subsection 4 indicates that on appeal, the appellate court may reverse or affirm the lower court sentencing decision. If the court does, in fact, reverse, the court will remand the case back to the sentencing court for resentencing. It also, in subsection 5, provides that if there is a reversal and the court and the sentence is remanded, the court must write a written opinion indicating why the sentence was reversed. If the sentence was not reversed, however, the court is not under a statutory obligation to write an opinion for its decision to uphold the sentence imposed. This was seen as important to keep the workload of the Court of Appeals at a reasonable level. It's important to note that in circumstances where the court believes that an opinion, where an affirmance has taken place, an opinion would help practitioners in the field or other courts interpret the guidelines, and the court certainly is free to write an opinion if it does choose to do so. This is also a provision that will allow the appellate courts to establish by rule a summary disposition of cases. The language that has been added, let me see. Indicates that, the appellate courts may provide by rule for summary disposition of cases arising under this section when no substantial question of law is presented by the appeal. This is a recommendation that came from Judge Joseph, and it was made based upon his observation that the court is now being swamped by a number of frivolous appeals. And this was an effort that he saw was a realistic provision that would help the court maintain its workload and be able to give its full attention to the truly substantive issues of sentencing. This provision is already included in the court's review of post-conviction relief. There is a similar provision currently in statute that does allow the appellate court that kind of a dismissal option. Subsection 6 provides for the right of both the state and the defendant to appeal a judgment of conviction based on the sentence. Once again, as you might recall, currently the state doesn't have the opportunity to appeal a sentence. So in this sense, this provision is new. It will now allow both the defendant and the state to appeal the sentence. And for both the state and the defendant, these provisions under the appellate review sections would apply.
Senator Springer.
Bob, is this consistent with Minnesota or Washington, or what kind of case was made for the state, granting the state that right? And we're concerned about workload. Seems to go the other way.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, yes, this is consistent with both Minnesota and Washington. I believe also with the federal system. The idea, I believe, or the concept behind this provision is that because the guidelines are intended to structure in more defined manner the sentencing process, that where there is error, the state is as much at need of an appeals process as is the defendant.
Thank you.
Jack.
Bob, on line 11, the exception language. Now, am I correct in understanding that the language except as provided in subsection 3 is meant to apply not only to subparagraph A, but paragraphs A through D? Line 11 on page 11.
Okay.
See the exception language I'm referring to?
Yes. Pardon me, counsel, could you repeat the question?
The exception language there now, is that meant intended to apply just to that subparagraph, the small a, or is it all four of the paragraphs, or A through D? You see what I'm asking?
Yes, but I... What could you answer that?
I believe it only applies to A.
It only applies to A? So, well, if it only applies to A, then, for instance, if we skip down to D, if we have a sentence that results from an agreement, but then under 3B, there's an error made in the crime serious classification, that would not be appealable?
Not as it's now drafted.
That gets into a policy issue, but I think that may.
Would you define? It is a policy.
You want to explore the policy issue for a moment here to talk about what policy was, why the policy issue was made in the way that it is in its narrowly construed manner, which is fine with me. I just think we need for the record to outline a recollection of the policy issue of why it applies only to A.
Well, as far as the specific example raised, Madam Chair, members, I think I'd have to answer it this way, that in the instance of plea agreements, the basic policy that was set forth was, first of all, that earlier we provided that if the plea agreement involves what would be an agreed departure sentence, the court has to make factual findings to justify that agreed sentence, but that the sentence and the justification stated for it would not, if it's in fact agreed and accepted by the court imposed, would not thereafter be subject to appeal for any reason that's within the scope of this section of the bill. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Well, I guess using that example, my question is, if there's a plea agreement that's accepted and the parties are all mistaken as to this crime series classification, trial counsel doesn't catch it, but for some other reason, perhaps it goes up on appeal, aside from the waiver questions, I want to know if that's appealable. And the answer I'm getting, I guess, is no.
I believe, Mr. Morris, as it's now drafted, the answer is it would not be appealable.
I think it's sort of the question we've sort of been skirting around about trying to figure out how. How ironclad is the plea agreement issue? Do you ever open that one up again when, you know, once you've signed on the dotted line to that, you know, how much are we going to allow under guidelines? And I think you'll find a policy direction that's coming to us, which is once you sign the plea agreement, you've pretty well, you better make very well sure that things are in order and that you know what you're doing and that you've decided that's what you want to do.
That, Madam Chair, that was probably a bad example to use. Perhaps we should use the example found in on line 13 in subparagraph B.
I'm sorry, found where, Mr. Morris?
Line 13. If the exception language in line 11 does not apply to that, if a defendant gets a sentence of probation under the optional probation, you're saying that's not appealable, even if there's a mistake in the crime category classification?
Yeah.
Is my question clear?
I think you're posing the same question. They're good questions. I think it's the same question.
Well,
it's a different example of the interplay between those two sections. I think it raises the same issue, which is...
Well, no, it doesn't, because this one doesn't necessarily entail a plea agreement. It could be after a finding of guilt at trial.
In my mind, it raises the same issue between how 3A and B relate to anything that's listed in sub 1.
Well, we need to sort this out.
I think you're on to a good point that will need to be pursued. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's fine. I think we've got two different examples of how they interrelate or don't interrelate, and we've got to make sure that we know how that's going to jack them up.
And the reason I initially asked the question was because it was my understanding that the exception language on line 11 would apply to all those subparagraphs.
Yeah. Well, I think...
And reading it in whole, that's the way it makes sense to me. Now, if that's...
I think that, as I
that's
say,
the answer I accept.
I think you're perhaps on to a very valid point, because to take your most recent example, if the court were to purport to sentence under the probationary option someone who isn't properly in one of those boxes, the rules actually you don't really have a sentence. When the rules prescribe, you don't really have a situation that literally falls under B or C, but it may be that in order to make absolutely clear that fact, that qualification language in terms of permitting you then to proceed to challenge that sentence, for the reason that that defendant is not in one of those boxes, in fact, according to the way you place offenders. He didn't get there properly in the first place. It may be that they, to clarify that indeed that would be a ground for challenge, for appeal, that the language, the exception language, is going to have to be broadened. Because I think it's safe to say that B and C assume or presume that in fact the offender has been put in one of those boxes correctly. And then, once they're correctly, the court's choice of one or the other of those sentences is, that choice is not going to be subject to review. If it's a choice that can be made without a departure. I don't know if I'm responding at all or not, whether I'm trying to say I think that while it may be that B and C imply that in fact the claim he's in the wrong box to start with would still be appealable.
I don't think
it may be necessary to make that clear by the way that exception language.
I think we've identified a problem at least.
I don't think we have a disagreement about the policy. I think it's just talking about language drafting. Because clearly, I'm sure I am correct in saying it would be the intention of the proposed legislation, not to repeat myself again, but if ex-offender is in the wrong box, either the state or the offender should be able to, depending on which way it is, too high or too low, to challenge that on appeal.
And that really has nothing to do with the happenstance that you happen to get an optional probationary sentence or one of those other conditions.
You'd never reach that question because it wouldn't be available to begin with.
Okay, we need a little work on that to clarify.
Right.
Make it explicit in the language what you're trying to do.
Thank you for reminding me.
Go ahead.
Finally, on the appellate review provisions, is a new subsection 7, which is being proposed in the amendments before you, that's lines 9 through 14 on page 1 of those amendments. This would require that notice of appeal must include the notice that the issue of sentencing will be raised in appeal. If that notice is not provided or if that information is not provided, then the offender or the state who raised the appeal would be foreclosed from raising the issue of sentencing in that proceeding or any other proceeding related to the sentencing. Moving on to parole and post-prison supervision sections, we're at section 22 on page 11 of the document. Section 22 merely changes the name of the parole board to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to reflect its new functions. Section 23 is a codification instruction that allows LC to make those changes throughout the criminal code. Section 24 amends ORS
14. Yes, I'm sorry. Can we back up to the amendment regarding the notice of appeal?
Yes.
I don't recall what the history of the discussion of this was, but my experience has been that oftentimes trial counsel and appellate counsel don't have an opportunity to confer with each other, and that would seem to be problematic in this respect. Oftentimes notices of appeals are filed at the last minute with the appellate attorney never having had a chance to talk to the defendant or the trial counsel, and I assume that's been discussed at some point.
Yes. Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, this is a provision that was once again recommended from Judge Joseph. His intent is merely to not allow for the issue of sentencing to be raised continually. He wanted to, my understanding is he wants to be certain that if the issue is going to be raised initially. I don't believe the council has had an opportunity to specifically consider what you have just raised as a concern.
The example that I could see is trial counsel raising the issue at sentencing, it being overruled, the objection or whatever, and then the notice of appeal is filed by appellate counsel who's unaware that there was ever any dispute. Now that's sloppy coordination between the two attorneys, but it happens. And I just wanted to know if that was discussed at all. because I think that may be a problem.
Mr. Morris, no, that specific issue had not been discussed.
We need to talk with Joseph and Crowd along with that, too, and clarify, figure out some way to...
Moving on to Section 24, amends ORS 144.040. This directs the board to determine whether an offender has violated the conditions of parole or post-prison supervision. Many of the sections in the next 20 or so sections broaden the board of parole's function to incorporate this new body of offenders who are under post-prison supervision. Section 25 amends ORS 144.050 to limit the application of parole, of the parole function, to those offenders who have sentenced outside of the guideline system or prior to the guideline system. Section 26 amends ORS 144.060. Once again, it reflects the change to the name of the parole board. It also includes post-prison supervision in the type of supervisory services provided by the Department of Corrections under contract or in contract with local governments. Section 27 amends ORS 144.075 to include transportation of post-prison supervision violators, as is now permitted for parole violators. Section 28 limits the statutory provisions related to the determination of parole release dates to those offenders sentenced under the current indeterminate sentencing system. These provisions include judicial mandatory minimum sentences. It does not, however, include ORS 144-260 or ORS 144-226 through 228. The 144-260 is notice of the offender's release. So offenders being released to post-prison supervision, the same notice that's now